Welcome back to another episode of Real Estate Investing Unscripted. I'm your co-host, Brendan Bennett, and with me is your other co-host, David Dugan. David, what is going on? It's good to be back.
Nice to be back here in 2024. It's probably been maybe 8 or 10 weeks since we've rolled one of these out, so it's good to be back.
Yeah, we've been in quite the planning phase, so we'll be bringing a little bit more of that passive investor side to you guys in 2024. So last year, we had a lot of investors on that were active real estate developers, people that were in and around that active developer industry. Part of our goal in 2024 is to really put a focus on this passive investor base. We want to get really strategic with how we locate capital, raise capital, and deploy that capital to our active investors. So you guys still may see one or two active developers from us throughout the year, but we thought it'd be great to show you guys some guests that are aligned with what our vision is for 2024. So, and David, who better than our guest today to kind of kick that off?
Yeah, the passive investor side, that is the oil that keeps the machine running here. And our first guest today will be Haseeb Rahman. Haseeb is a portfolio manager with Palisades. Palisades is an investment management firm that we work closely with. He's been there for about 10 years. I will allow Haseeb to come right on in and elaborate more on his background with Palisades and tell us all about what he does. Haseeb, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, guys. Actually, funnily enough, today is my 10-year anniversary with Palisades.
Oh, congrats.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so a little bit just about myself. I started my career in investment banking on the sell side at Raymond James. So I was doing mergers and acquisitions and capital raising advisory, focusing on financial institutions, so banks, asset managers, insurance companies. And then eventually wanted to make my way over to be a principal investor. Looked at a lot of different things, but and always had kind of a penchant towards like real estate. And I'm a math guy, so I like credit. It's a lot easier to, in my opinion, to model. And so in 2014, I came over to Palisades as a quant on the trading desk really was focusing on building, enhancing, running valuation, cash flow modeling, a lot of the upfront trading work for us. At the time, the firm was quite a bit different. We were really a company that was born out of the financial crisis. We were set up to be kind of like a turnkey solution for institutional capital that wanted to invest in the residential distressed whole loan space coming out of the financial crisis, but you know, for folks who didn't have a platform set up. So at the time, that's kind of exclusively what we were focused on, which is non-performing and reperforming residential whole loans for, call it, the first 5 years of the business. I've done a lot of things at the firm over the years, and getting involved with people operations, HR, ESG, a variety of other things. But today I'm a portfolio manager here. So kind of get involved with overseeing pretty much everything related to the investment process here at Palisades. A lot of my work still covers a lot of that front end trading, valuation, sourcing type work.
Very cool. And before we get into a little bit more about the way that Palisades is structured and Haseeb, the different roles that you have there, David, can you give a quick breakdown to the audience about how Upright and Palisades work together? Just a little bit more details between how our two businesses collide.
Yeah. Haseeb could probably touch on this more than I can, but Palisades is what we consider as an institutional capital partner. So, you know, their role is to come in and be a whole loan buyer for the loans that we originate. You know, effectively, the way that works is we'll show Haseeb a loan tape, or you know, Justin over in our finance office will do that. And the two of them will discuss, you know, the buy box you guys are looking for and how much you want to allocate. And then you guys will come in and buy those loans from us. We recoup our liquidity and then we put it back into the market with new loans. So that's kind of the 40,000 foot view. Haseeb, fill in where I may have missed there on kind of how that relationship works with you and Justin and how you guys like to operate with us.
Yeah. I mean, like we, to Brendan's point, we are a passive investor. We're not a lender ourselves. So we partner with the Uprights of the world, and this is just one asset class that we play in. With you guys, we play in a bunch of different asset classes, and you know, our business has evolved over the years with you guys and with where we're at today. We're buying newly originated performing, you know, credit, unlike the early days. So we usually set up what I'll call like flow agreements with folks like yourself, where we kind of say the type of product that we're looking for, and hopefully it's a fit in terms of what type of product you're producing, and then you guys go and produce it, and we buy it on the run into, you know, we have a variety of kind of passive investment vehicles, both, you know, that are internal funds, the Palisades brand, if you will, funds, as well as funds that we manage for other large institutions. And so we buy those into those funds, and we work with Upright on the go as well. You guys retain the borrower relationship and work with us alongside us as the loans kind of mature.
Super helpful. And yeah, for the listeners, companies like Palisades, they kind of support a lot of this larger hard money lending industry, right? So Upright's a little bit unique in the sense that we have the retail platform, which is where David specializes and works on. So we kind of have like a two-pronged approach or a three-pronged approach, depending on how you want to look at it, with our funds. Haseeb and groups like Haseeb are a huge part of our business, and any of the really top 100 hard money lenders, if you're a borrower out there looking for funds, they're very likely connected to Haseeb and Palisades or someone similar to them. So very cool to kind of see a peek behind the curtain on this side of the house, because we, again, talk a ton about where people should get money from lenders like us, but we don't really talk about where we source our funds. So to that point, Haseeb, when we talked a week ago, you broke down your business in, I think, a very, very simple way that I think can kind of structure this conversation for us. So you talked about raising capital, deploying capital, and then getting the return. And then there's a little bit of asset management there in some cases. So can we start with the raising capital? So like, where do you guys get your money from? What does that process look like? Whatever you can share with us on that side.
So raising capital, like I mentioned, we, you know, V1 of the business, we were really focusing on the latter two spokes of what you talked about, the deploying capital and getting a return on that capital for other institutions. So we weren't really doing much of the raising capital piece of it. And then, you know, fast forward 5 years, in 2017, we started raising our own funds, and that's when we really started building out that capital raising arm of the business. So, you know, there's both equity and debt capital that we need, and for our fund vehicles, we use both equity and debt. So we go out to limited partners or allocators that range from university endowments to family offices to high net worth individuals to pensions, public pensions and stuff like that. And as to how we do that, you know, it's just networking on steroids, really. It's like going to conferences, cold reach outs, you know, friends of friends, and you know, going and pitching and working through. It's a long sales cycle. But that's really the what I'll call the equity side. The debt side, you know, with our fund vehicles, in most cases, especially with the rehab and construction loan product, we usually buy the loans and then we'll actually finance them on the back end as well. So there's kind of two forms of financing that we go to for the debt that we use. One of which is like warehouse lending, which is kind of revolving credit lines that we get from like a bank or a non-bank. And that's kind of what I'll call non-permanent financing that we kind of use on the run. In some cases, we'll actually go and issue a bond and we'll do a securitization, which is what I'll call like more permanent financing. And that's when bond investors are involved, and that the, you know, folks who invest in bonds can range from banks to insurance companies to money managers to sovereign wealth funds, what have you, you know, folks that are trading securities, RMBS and CMBS and other, you know, types of securities.
Makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. So, Haseeb, I want to dive into that a little bit more. You guys will manage investment funds and buy other sorts of assets or debt aside from just residential real estate, correct?
We have pretty much exclusively focused on Resi. With the rehab and construction loan product, we've done a little bit of multifamily and mixed use. But we don't really get into like commercial or, you know, other types of debt products.
That's perfect, because that'll make this next question really easy for you then. You know, I think our passive investor base always wants to know, you know, who else is playing in this space, right? Why should I feel good about it? I want to know who's putting their money into the asset class that I am also putting my money into. So when you're out there in your fundraising efforts, where are you going to raise money, right? What types of companies, what types of people?
Yeah. So, you know, like I mentioned, there's two verticals to our business. One is where we're managing kind of third-party institutional capital. That's going to be, you know, some of like the largest money managers, private equity funds, hedge funds, family offices in the world. On our own, like Palisades vehicles, those are like private university endowment funds. That's going to be funds of funds, super institutional quality type investors that buy into the thesis, who like the space, who like the story, who like the, you know, macro and microeconomic backdrop. I can't really like name names, but yeah, it's going to be like healthcare endowments, like I said, pensions, foundations, you know, but these are investors that are, you know, managing multi-billion-dollar pools of capital that, you know, are putting slugs into our funds.
And Haseeb, before we move on to the deploying capital side of things, when it comes to raising capital, what would you say is like the Palisades value prop when you guys go to approach these different insurance companies or whatever the vehicles are? What is it that gets people excited to invest with Palisades as opposed to a different aggregator out in the space similar to you guys?
Yeah. I mean, as it relates to this specific space, like meaning rehab and construction loans, and just private money lending, you know, we are, I think, probably the one aggregator, a larger aggregator out there that has that kind of a history rooted in non-performing loan management. That's really, you know, embedded in our DNA. You know, that kind of default management, risk mitigation, loss mitigation is really, you know, something that we've grown up with. And it's we take that kind of high touch, deep underwrite approach as it relates to this asset class. And I think, you know, over the years, this is becoming an institutional asset class in the last, call it 5 years, five to 7 years. And it hasn't historically been for a variety of reasons, you know, one of which, you know, being a hard money lending is just the moniker itself sounds weird. But because there's, you know, it's not like a built house in many, or it's not a finished house, let's call it. And so there's project risk here that you don't take with just like a conventional loan. It requires a lot more of an underwrite, as well as the treasury management for the asset is pretty high touch, as you guys know just as good as we do, in terms of you can't predict what construction draws and timelines and all that kind of stuff. And we gotta, you know, reserve cash on our side. And it's not just dependent on the borrower and the project, it's also dependent on broader market and sub-market, right, you know, things. So there's a lot of different factors that go into managing the asset. And I think coming with that background of non-performing loan management, we've kind of recycled a lot of the infrastructure and processes that we had on that asset to what goes into this asset. And I think that's one of our big edges in the space.
That makes a ton of sense, and I'm drawing a lot of parallels between your business and our business, right? And perhaps that's why we work well together, right? But like I think about the folks that I work with on the passive investing side, right? Like the individual accredited investors, they like us for all of those same reasons that you mentioned, because of the underwriting standards and how we look at a deal from multiple angles, because of, you know, how we look at the credit worthiness of the individual borrower, you know, because of how we understand the risk in the asset class and how to mitigate that and how we manage the assets throughout the life of the loan. Sounds like you guys are doing a lot of the same things, and I think that's important, right? If you're putting your money into residential real estate, specifically these RTL loans, which, by the way, RTL, that is a newer term to me, right? Residential transition yeah. loan. Like, when I would work on the origination side, it was always, you know, hard money, short-term debt, bridge loans, right? So the RTL asset class, yeah, it's, you know, I think you want to work with somebody that has a full understanding of what that means and how to manage that asset. So anyway,
yeah,
makes a ton of sense.
On that point, like, we've worked with almost 70 different originators in this space over the years, and that universe of folks that we buy from and that we deal with has really shrunk. We've shrunk it down actively over the last few years to, you know, a dozen to two dozen different folks, and, you know, mainly because it's the best partnerships and the best underwriters that are kind of rising to the top. And I think one thing that is good about you guys, and we tend to find, you know, the originators that have their own kind of fund vehicles or their own kind of vehicles to invest and have skin in the game tend to be the best underwriters and produce the best product. So the fact that you guys have, you know, brand value associated with quality performing loans with your retail side, you know, that's your skin in the game. And so it's like everything that you produce, you need to be willing to put your own money into. And so we tend to find that the originators that have, you know, it's a kind of a weird thought in the sense that on the one hand, as an aggregator, as a buyer of loans, we're a little bit worried that we're getting the worst product if you have your own pocket of capital. But if you have a good partner, then you, you know, that worry gets, and you get to see what kind of everything that's produced through the organization. You're making sure you're getting a good cross section of the portfolio. So, yeah, we tend to find that those are the better originators.
Yeah, Haseeb, it's a great transition too into the deploying capital side. I'm curious. So you said you've worked with up to 70 lenders over the year. You're now down to 12. Do those 12 differ a lot in location, specialty? So are you going for diversity across those 12 lenders, or are you finding, you know, 11 other lenders that are very similar to Upright, for example, and kind of have a similar product mix, similar borrower offering? How do you guys structure those 12 like arms of that origination?
It's, you know, it's a mix of different things. Some of it is regional. So they're like, you know, like Pacific Northwest originators tend to be concentrated to that area. And then like California has their own, you know, set of originators that really focus out there. But then separately, it really, like, we're trying to go a mile deep and an inch wide with the best partners. I want to kind of scale with fewer people. I mean, part of it is just the sheer operational lift of dealing with 50 plus different people is like not great from just efficiency and, you know, an operational perspective. So that, you know, so it's really just picking the best folks and kind of scaling with them. And I think, you know, there's kind of a getting to know each other phase in the beginning of when you meet a new originator. And when you start buying, the best way to kind of get to know each other is just to get in the flow of buying and selling loans with each other, looking at an underwriting deals together. And you can tell when somebody, you know, when it clicks in terms of you guys are producing the type of product that we're looking for, and or you can cater what you're producing to what we're looking for, and you kind of, and we kind of understand each other. And so, you know, that there's a lot of upfront work in terms of picking the originators and due diligencing them and underwriting them. And then there's, you know, on the run, that kind of maturation process that occurs, which is super important.
This may be somewhat of an obvious question, Haseeb, but what gets you most excited when you're prospecting a new originator? Like, what's some of the one or two things that's going to push you over the edge to bring them into that group of 12? And on the other side, what's kind of the cause for firing of an originator? Again, I think the answer is obvious, but just to hear it from you would be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, look, like we look at past performance. I think that's super important to take a look at. You know, what has delinquency and loss experience been like, you know, for you guys? Obviously, that requires some track record. So you're not like just setting up shop and starting to sell loans type of thing. But, you know, you'd be surprised, like the private money lending or hard money lending. I mean, maybe you actually probably wouldn't be surprised, but, you know, it really runs the gamut in terms of, you know, two guys in an Excel sheet to like really institutional on the other end. And we, you know, we've talked to folks who will, you know, one of the features of this space, given it's not a consumer loan, is that when a loan is in default, you can charge really high interest rates as long as they're not, you know, up to usury rates. And there are lenders out there who want to write loans that default that also are, you know, well equitized, because they want that default interest and that rate of return. They're fine taking the assets back and all that. And it's like, we're not trying to be in this business to have a lot of defaults and get money in that, or get our yield in that manner. And so, like, that's kind of big red flag on the front end. Really having, like, built out systems, processes, teams, understanding, like, you know, do we philosophically feel the same way about underwriting, and how we view submarkets? What are we looking at? You know, folks who have good reason for doing the product and the geos that they're in. You know, are like demographic trends looking positive? Are you even looking at that kind of thing? Or, you know, do you just lend in this area because it happens to be where you live, or where you're based? And so a lot of that kind of feeds into it. And you know, like I said, we going through live deals with folks, you get a pretty quick understanding of whether somebody's what I'll call a sales dominant organization versus like an underwriting dominant organization. You know, there, unfortunately, you know, a lot, and it's just the nature of the beast with mortgage origination or origination in general, is a sales focused business in many cases, and volume often is the name of the game, and kind of in spite of quality. So kind of assessing that out is super important on the front end. As to why someone would get kicked out, everything's all good when the market's good. When things start turning and there are projects that go bad, or borrowers that go delinquent and issues start cropping up, you know, there's one side of originator that's going to be a true partner and like trying to work with you to figure out creative ways, taking some of the hit themselves, you know, in some cases, to just like, we both want to kind of work through this in the most economical fashion and as fast as possible, and then move on to like performing loans. And then there's the other end, which is like, I'm trying to get my piece out of this regardless, you know, what that means for our partnership. And if you, you know, it's like penny wise, pound foolish. 'Cause it's like, if you, you know, you act that way in that scenario, we're not going to keep buying from you. We don't want to, it's not a partnership mentality, and we know if like the chips are down, you're not going to be on our side.
Unlock your real potential. Dive into passive real estate investing with Upright. Make your first investment at upright.us/podcast, and we'll put $200 in your investment wallet. Whether you're looking for a tax-advantaged managed fund to earn long-term income, or you want to actively manage your investments in individual properties, investment opportunities are available with as little as $1,000 minimum investments. Go to upright.us/podcast to make your first investment. Terms apply. Read full details at upright.us/podcast.
In a similar vein, I want to talk more about the deal specific side, right? Because, you know, like we just talked about originators and what makes you like them. When you boil it down to the individual deal, you know, we kind of look at it as two pieces, right? You've got borrower risk, you've got deal related risk, and each of those has its own set of criteria. So, from an institutional perspective, and perhaps from a personal perspective, because I imagine that's why you're in the role that you're in, is because your personal perspective is really honed in on what Palisades is looking for. What are you looking for in a deal? And are you analyzing risk in the same way, from borrower risk, deal risk? And, you know, what are some of the data points you look for that make or break a deal for you?
I mean, we're definitely analyzing it in a similar way. I think for borrower risk, we dig into actual, we're not, you know, when someone says they've done three projects in the last 36 months or whatever, we actually look at what those projects were and make sure that those are in line with what the subject project is. So like if it's, you know, they've only done $5,000 flip, you know, budget flips, and now they're building a $700,000 home, you know, it doesn't line up. So like, have you done the type of project that you're about to undertake? You know, if their credit score is not the best, you know, we dig into the credit report and understand, like, is it because you've been delinquent on loans or on credit lines and whatnot? Or is it because you just don't take debt out and you don't have like a long history, or you know, something like that, that's kind of, you know, a mitigating factor. You know, my personal kind of view on this is, if there's profit in a deal or there's value in a deal, then borrowers and people will find a way to get the project done, get their equity out. And so a lot of our focus when we're looking at deals from you guys and others is on value. And we're looking at not just what the appraisal says, but we're looking, you know, we're doing a re-underwrite and looking at actual sales activity to what we believe to be comps, you know, of sold loans and sold homes and listed homes. You know, is it a market that's flooded with inventory and a bunch of list price reductions that are going on? Or is it, you know, a good fast moving market where, you know, value can really be validated? And is there cushion there too? You know, so if the market takes a 5-10 point hit, is there still profit in the deal for the borrower? Because, you know, that's kind of like an unforeseen type of thing. And, you know, part of the reason that these loans, they're short duration, you know, 9-12 month type terms and life cycle of these loans. So you get a little bit less market risk there, but, you know, it's something we still look at. You know, if, you know, like when the Fed started raising, there was like a hit in home prices there for a bit, especially that was localized in a lot of places that got super hot during the pandemic. And so, you know, when there's not profit in the deal, when there's a lot less equity for the borrower, you know, that's when things go wrong, we tend to find.
So Haseeb, once you have that micro level deal, for example, underwritten, your next, after you purchase a loan and you're now moving it over to your servicing side of the house, now the real work kind of sets in, right? You gotta work to get the return for yourselves and then for your investors where you guys are getting the money from. Can you walk us through like that third pillar of your guys' business of what kind of things impact that rate of return, what things are, you know, jeopardizing to that rate of return, and how do you guys manage that?
We have, I think, like 40 employees, and we, I think, just crossed over like $15.5 billion in AUM. I think we have like 45,000 loans on our platform. So, you know, we're lean, and we use a lot of technology. We're not a servicer ourselves, so we partner with third party servicers that specialize in specific products and specialize in certain types of situations. Like some services are better for non-performing loans than they are for performing than some are at non-performing loans, as an example. And so what we're really doing is using technology, data, our database and analytics to find outliers, find issues. Obviously, if a loan is delinquent, then that's on a watch list and something we have to deal with. So, you know, and generally speaking, we give like delegated authority to the servicers to do things that are within acceptable parameters, but every kind of major economic decision as it relates to an asset, whether that's a construction draw or approving a foreclosure bid price, you know, from the lender or whatever, every economic decision is made by our asset management team. And so what we're doing is culling the portfolio for at-risk loans and kind of playing whack-a-mole with our asset management team and trying to trim as much of the risk as possible that we can control early and often, and being as proactive as possible there. So, you know, that's, you know, credit to our BI team, our database and the everything that we've built on top of our database and the workflow tools and stuff that we have that's it on top of that is where a lot of the value at our firm is. And that's, you know, been built over the whole, you know, 10 years that I've been here, which allows, you know, few people to do a lot and be quick and efficient about working through that kind of stuff.
I think we've covered a ton of what we wanted to cover here with you, but I want to hear from you personally, Haseeb. You live and breathe this asset class every day, just like we do, right? And we get asked for our opinion on the market outlook, and I generally derive my opinion from people smarter than me. So here's another instance of that. How do you view the market moving forward in 2024 and beyond? Why are you bullish on it? If so, why? And where do you think residential real estate's headed?
Yeah, I mean, look, I generally get my opinions from people smarter than me as well. But look, like, you know, I think, and we talk about this a lot in an investment committee here, is like, we don't have a crystal ball on where we're going or where the general economy is going, but I think we can all safely assume there's a wide dispersion of outcomes over the next 24 months. And I think, like, you know, the market's really been believing and pricing in that there's, you know, rate cuts are imminent, and then, you know, that's kind of starting to change. And like, even like Larry Summers, one of the Fed guys, like on Friday said that we may actually have rate hikes again. And so a lot of different things, you know, that are playing into the broader market. And so, you know, one of the reasons that we still, you know, from a kind of macro housing level space that we like this space is that, is what I mentioned before, which is that it's short duration. You know, on a scaled portfolio, 20 to 25% of our portfolio pays off in a quarter. So that allows you to pivot or just pause if market dynamics change. And I think there's a lot of positive dynamics. Like, there's a lot of stress coming for the commercial side. I think everyone can agree on that. You know, mostly a lot, you know, focused on the office sector especially. But on the residential side, you know, people have been talking about mortgage rates and how that has really crushed affordability and demand, and it has. But supply is still super constrained. And I think, like, what we look at are our supply and demand parity metrics and where is supply going to come from. And demand is still outpacing supply. So, you know, we have, I think, like 1.5 million housing units right now, which is meaningfully below the historical average. I think days on market is still at, you know, historical lows. We look at, you know, month supply. I think we're just above 3 months of month supply in the market, which I think, like, a quote unquote healthy market is 5 to 7 months. You know, those are all the types of factors that we look at as to why, from kind of a market tailwind perspective, that we like building supply into an undersupplied market in spite of, rates and affordability being what it is. And, you know, those kind of metrics that I just quoted, they're trending in the wrong direction relative to where they were in the pandemic. But the pandemic was historical lows. So we're still, you know, the trends are moving towards what I'll call a healthier market, but we're still, relative to history, relatively undersupplied. So that's kind of like, and the other thing too, I think 80%+ of homeowners have mortgage rates sub 5%. So, you know, especially right now where mortgage rates are 7%+, people aren't moving out of their homes. They're not selling. And so the supply is not coming, or not coming from existing housing stock, which is historically speaking is where most of the supply comes from. So that's, you know, we tend to focus a lot more on the new construction side of the spectrum. And so that's kind of why we still like, you know, this space quite a bit. I think the other thing too, just for residential real estate too, I think one of the metrics I quote is if you look at the loan to value ratio of the US in 2010 versus today, in like 2010, it's in like the 60-70 type range. Today we're in the 30s. And the other piece is like 40% of the housing market is cash. So there's a lot of staying power in my personal view, with the residential real estate market as we sit here today. So we're still constructive and bullish on the space. And the other thing too, you know, we, you know, this is part of why we like to partner with folks who are strong underwriters is deal level specific too. If, you know, where we tend to play is pretty low attachment points to value, like 60-70% type loan to value ratio. So the housing market can take a decent bit of heat before we as a loan investor are taking heat on our portfolio.
Haseeb, if I can steal one more question from you. I think David and I and people within our company have seen a lot of the top 10 originators either move to doing in-house securitizations like the Kiavis of the world, right? They're doing securitizations, they're going to market, doing similar stuff to what you guys are doing, just in a different vein. And then we also see other originators do this kind of captive capital, right? Where they partner with an institution similar to you guys, and they have that commitment agreement for so much equity and debt split. How do you see that space evolving in the next 12 to 18 months? Do you see more originators standing up securitizations in-house? Do you see more of that captive capital arrangement kind of settling in? Or do you think that there's a different horizon out there? Like, what's your guys' thesis on that?
You know, honestly, I'm not sure. I think part of what led to a lot of that captive origination business was, you know, especially in the pandemic, it was extremely, as an investor, it was extremely competitive out there. In that kind of market, you could only really compete on price. And so for, you know, folks like us to get the types of returns that we wanted, you compete on price, but then, and then you have to lever up your portfolios quite a bit to get to the same types of returns. And so I think a lot of folks were like, if you can't beat them, join them, you know, type of mentality of let's just make the asset production piece of this, you know, be in-house, and then we're not, you know, playing hand-to-hand combat out there and competing on price. And so, and not to mention you get the fee streams and revenue streams that come from being an originator. You know, in this type of market, I think you may see a little bit less of that. That's more of a personal view than like a house view. You know, it also depends on what the bond market, you know, the securitization market looks like. Which 2023 was a tough year for the securitization market, and especially for this type of space where, you know, this isn't the down the fairway consumer, you know, conventional 30-year loan product. This is a loan that, you know, it gets dispersed over time, that has project risk and borrower risk and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's considered more of an esoteric asset class when it comes to the bond market. And so that, you know, the bond market's recovered quite a bit in the last, you know, 3 months, let's call it. If that is how things kind of stay and there's some stability there and pricing and what happens in the bond market stays strong, which is where it's at today, then I think you'll see, you know, that have ripple effects down the chain to folks like myself, to folks like you guys, you know, both on production volumes and pricing, but also what happens from a consolidation and kind of vertical integration perspective. But if there, you know, if it's a logjam like it was last year, then you know, it'll be tough for people to justify,
right?
Because it has a trickle. You know, the whether somebody's a buyer or an investor that uses financing or not, people look to the bond market to be kind of an indicator of how they should be participating in the space and the health of and the liquidity of the space.
Steve, this has been awesome. I think, you know, for our kickoff into the passive investor world, what better person to have on here than you, right? Like I said, pre-existing relationship, you know the industry well, you brought us a ton of insight. So I want to thank you for giving us your time this morning and coming on the podcast. Any parting words that you have for Brendan, myself, our audience, anything we didn't touch on that you want to hop in with?
No, nothing for me, but you know, I appreciate the time as well, and love having you guys as a partner, and looking forward to continue to grow and see how this year goes.
Likewise.
Awesome. Thanks, Haseeb.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thanks again for tuning into this week's show. Make sure to let us know what you think or write in with suggestions, guests, or topics at podcast@upright.us. And if you like the show, click that like and subscribe button and give us a 5-star rating wherever you are listening. And check out our other episodes of Real Estate Investing Unscripted on all of your favorite podcast platforms. We'll see you guys next time.